Welcome to the post-correction phase of the Planetary Tantra Talks. And with the main Turton, John Lash, in mega high gear as we navigate with the Wisdom Goddess, please let this passage from the Nag Hammadi Codices sink deeply into your consciousness. When Pistis saw the impiety of the Lord Archon, she was filled with anger. Acting in her invisible form, she spoke in this way: "You are mistaken, blind one, false deity who cannot see. There is an immortal, luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you, and who will appear among your mottled forms. This luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as a potter's clay is pounded into a lump. And you will sink away to your proper zone, the abyss of gravity, along with those who belong to your legion. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archontic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished, and that illusion will be as if never had been. On the Origin of the World." Okay, and welcome to Planetary Tantra Talk number 10, following on the heels of just a couple days ago, a Planetary Tantra Talk number 9, Navigating with the Wisdom Goddess. And we are just going to continue on with where we were 2 days ago. And I mentioned at that time that I was just kind of hanging on to the coattails of the main Turton and going wherever he's leading. And actually the talk... The previous talk felt more like actually riding on a magic carpet to me than hanging on to coattails. So I hope we will continue with that flow of conversation today. So John, I'd like to welcome you to Planetary Tantra Talk number 10. And we are now into the double digits.
Yes, thank you, Thomas. It's amazing. And your dedication and perseverance are fantastic. I have no words to tell you how much I appreciate you making this possible.
Well, it's just a natural interest that I have in what you're doing. So it's not a burden, or it's not a feeling of work at all. It's an absolute pleasure to do this.
Well, for me as well, you know, I mentioned, or I don't know if I mentioned it in our last talk, or perhaps it was in one that I did recently for American Freedom Radio, that the Telestai, the Hierophants, and the more advanced members of the Mystery Cells had an extraordinary skill for vetting the neophytes and the people that were coming in. You know, the initiates, the Telestai, were great educators, and they were teachers as well as mystics. And they combined the highest qualities of teaching and mystical practice. And one of the skills of a good teacher is to recognize and draw out. That's what education means, isn't it? Educate means to draw forth. The dispositions of the student. And the mystery teachers did that, you know, and no one has actually described this in detail, but if you look at some of the iconography of the Eleusinian mysteries, you see the woman... who is the bearer of the sacred basket. Mm-hmm. And she is often represented as a caryatid on a column. The woman who is the bearer of the sacred basket in the Eleusinian mysteries is a young initiate of a Gnostic cell who brings balanced on our head the basket in which is contained the psychoactive plants. And engraved on those baskets, engraved on the coffers in which the mushrooms and the various formulas that they made of the gaikion were kept, engraved on those artifacts, some of which are surviving, is a rosette of 12 petals. And the reason for that is because the internal structure and organization of the mysteries was based on an 8 and 16 principle. So there were basically 8 men or 16 men and women in a Gnostic cell. And they were the ones who had seen the organic light, and they were united by their shamanic practices and by their ability to observe the organic light, learn from it, which is called the divine mathesis, instruction by the light. But the mysteries were a totally egalitarian and open matter. They were not secret in the sense that some kind of manipulation of humanity or some kind of mind programming agenda was being conducted behind the scenes. They were only secret in the sense that if you went into it, you know, what you do, an Aikido, Kendo, or whatever it's called, what the members of the Kendo, what the members of the Aikido team around the master are doing is secret. Secret in the sense that it's kept to themselves within the environment that they're working on it, but not secret in the sense that it's being used to propagate an agenda against the world at large. Do you understand that difference?
Yes, I do.
You
and
would
it's
very well because
it's
you've been
open
in such
to
a tradition.
And it's open then to new initiates as
it's
well.
Totally
it's not
open,
a closed.
But,
yeah.
But you don't bring in a new initiate into a class of the advanced students because it's not good for either the advanced students or the initiates to mingle in that manner, is it?
Yes.
So the Telestai did the same, and to get back to the point I'm making, which because this comes back to you, the bearer of the grail basket, as we might call it, was a young girl who brought in the sacred medicines. And there's a rosette of 12 petals on these baskets. Because what happened was that in the Eleusinian mysteries, this is just one way it was done. It was done in other ways in the Levant, and still in other ways in Egypt, more secretive. But anybody who wanted to could participate in the open festival of the Eleusinian mysteries in the spring. And then they could come back in the fall for the greater mysteries. And out of the people who had participated in the lesser mysteries, the neophytes and the telestai who were hanging around the precincts would choose groups of 12. So say that there were in one season, one fall season, 4 or 5 hierophants or advanced teachers of the organic light at Eleusis. Each one of those 4 or 5, they could be men or women, would select out of the group of hundreds and hundreds of participants 12 people. And they would take those 12 people into the telesterion, the inner sanctuary, and they would do what we now call a mushroom ceremony with them. And in that way, people were initiated and brought into the inner circle, and if they proved to be dedicated to the process, and if they proved to have the concentration required, then they would eventually become members of the inner cells, and they would join a cell of 8 or 16 telestai. But all of that depended upon the perception of the advanced initiates of the disposition of the people who were coming in. Did they have a true disposition for magic or not? You see?
Mm-hmm.
And so those who have a true disposition for magic come into planetary tantra, don't they?
Yes, they do. And they hang along and hang in there as long as they can. And some survive and some don't.
Most who will come will stay because the calling is so perfect and clear from the initial moment. And as you know, it's not a gradual process. It seizes your entire being. What we're doing here is the follow-up of Carlos Castaneda.
Mm-hmm.
It is magical realism made real. It is magical realism in practice. You know, as Don Juan said, and this is the last thing I want to say before we get back into our topic, because I don't want to take up too much time. But as Don Juan said once, at the end of, I think, the fourth book of Castaneda, I was talking with Don Hinero, and he were talking about various exploits of sorcery and shamanism. And Don Juan turned to Carlos and said, "Hey, what I'm saying to you right now, amigo, is just tales of power. But they will be acts of power for you." So you begin with tales of power, and it seems like it's just a story. But then you live that story, and it becomes acts of power. And this is how the process works and how it's always worked.
Yes, indeed. Well, the doors are open wide, and things are getting extremely interesting, as anybody who's been following this and reading what you wrote in the month of June are well aware of. Very exciting stuff.
Right. PT goes fractal. And I'd like to just repeat again what I mean by that.
Sure.
I want to reiterate the point that when we look at the Sophianic vision story in its 9-episode framework, we have the sacred directive myth of the mysteries, which I have restored. And the directive power of this myth consists in the plot structure, in the integrity of the story arc. So we're going to demonstrate that, and when talking about the Archons now a little bit at the beginning of this second introductory talk to our new series, I'd like to demonstrate to you how observation of the story arc and faithful fidelity to the plot structure is where the power is, where you connect to the power of the myth. You do not connect to the power of the Sophia myth by pulling out the snippet of the Archons and the mind parasite meme and chattering that about the land. You do not connect with the Sophia myth by invoking the name Gaia Sophia, which people are doing more and more frequently. You have to carry the entire story. That's what it means. You know, some people might think, and this is a dream, and this is kind of a new age metaphysical conception that I ran into many times in my years teaching in Santa Fe and in L.A. Oh, the universe is a great mystery, and we're all a part of the mystery. And it's sort of like no one can really know it all, like those old Gnostics were accused of doing, you know. No one can know it all, because it's like a big jigsaw puzzle. And each one of us, just think how wonderful it is that each one of us carries a piece of that puzzle. And maybe the life of each person is a piece of the great jigsaw puzzle that is the universe. And isn't that wonderful that we all contribute in that way? Well, that may be a very wonderful fantasy, folks, but actually it's not that way. In my understanding, we do not each carry a puzzle piece of the great mystery. If you carry the great mystery, you carry it in its entirety. It propagates fractally. So, you know, I use that analogy, Thomas, and I hope it's helpful. A holographic plate has an image on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Say the image of Shark Cathedral is on a holographic plate. And when you subject that image to laser lights, it produces the hologram of the Shark Cathedral. But you can break that holographic plate into fragments and hold up any one fragment and project the laser lights through it, and it will still produce the entire image of Shark Cathedral. Every person who carries the biography of the sacred myth of Sophia reproduces it entirely. You don't carry a piece of the puzzle. You carry the entire puzzle. And this is what's happening now. I wasn't predicting when I said Tiki goes fractal in June. I don't know. I don't predict. I just had a gut feeling that that's what was happening. And I must say that thanks to you and Stephanie and Terry, who have done the recorded versions of the narration, when that myth went out in spoken form, twice in a female voice and once in a male voice, I truly believe that the fractal effect began to occur exactly at that moment.
Yeah, I can understand that very well. That one approach that you mentioned, the first approach is a very fragmented one, and one is a fractal approach where you contain the whole story, the whole thing. That's why it resonates with you when you connect into it, when you give the time to absorb the whole story.
Exactly. You know, we're on a fractal path here, and I assure you, because I have confidence of practice, that this fractal path brings you into the absolute core of human potential, and we are very close to hitting that core. And Sophia herself right now is working out of that core in a most magnificent fashion. You know, the role of the Nahual is twofold: to provide syntax and to steady the approach to the unknown or the supernatural. So my goal as a navigator and teacher of Planetary Tantra, navigator of the Gaian mothership adventure, is simply to do that, to steady the approach to the supernatural. The supernatural is coming to a theater near you. We don't have to worry about getting there. It's coming to us. And I don't say it will come. I say it is coming now. And the things that people are writing to me, Thomas, are so remarkable. I can't tell you that people are writing me almost daily now with the most remarkable and consistent experiences. This is the other thing. Consistent within the frame of the story, consistent within the simple framework or paradigm, if you will, of Planetary Tantra, which is a very simple paradigm, as you know. So I don't predict, but I would like to say that I can see that Sophia's intervention into the human situation is happening. And rather than predict and say what she will do or what's going to happen, I'd rather prefer to talk about opportunities. So let's talk about that for the remainder 45 minutes of this wonderful interview.
Fantastic. All right, so let's get into where we left off. And the last time you left off requesting me to ask you to talk about how Sophia is, what the evidence is of Sophia taking down the Archon, or not taking down the Archons, taking down the Archontic influence here on Earth. And as kind of a lead-in before we jump into that, I do want to go back to the moon for just a short segue, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay, now we talked about the moon and kind of the three options that were given in standard media and standard education. One is that it just happened by chance, you know, it's a cosmic, chaotic occurrence. One is that it's made by God, you know, that would be the other alternative. And then the other one is kind of the new thing that we're hearing now is that it's an artificial construct by an alien race. But I would propose that, and we won't know this until we get the information in real time, but that the other option is that it is either made by Gaia Sophia herself, or that she incorporated an already existing body, and then to make things work out with eclipses and the tides and everything to work properly, she could adjust how her size of her body morphs, or her distance from the moon, or however. And I was just wondering if you could kind of comment on how that might play out.
Yes, you know, up until now, science has not provided us with a convincing theory of the origin of the moon. And it's a rare thing, but if you run across an honest scientist, and they're very rare, they'll tell you that they don't know, you know. So there have been two or three theories. One of them is that the moon was, you know, torn out of the Earth at some point, whatever. Currently now, because we don't know, because we're lacking a convincing and testable theory of how the moon was created, which is contained in the sacred myth, by the way, people are grasping for straws. You know, people in their ignorance and their blindness are grasping for straws. And unfortunately, if you combine that with the human tendency to want to be thrilled and lulled by make-believe, we fall right into the hands of the Archons very quickly, and you fall into make-believe theories. And the big make-believe theory now that's getting discussed and getting kicked around the internet is the theory of the artificial moon. And it's very closely connected with the Sumerian Anunnaki scenario of Sitchin. Unfortunately, those two things are now linked together. Maybe it's good that they're linked together because they're both going down in the same crash. And they're going down as I speak. Anyway, you know, unfortunately, David Icke was talking with Credo Mutwa, and Credo Mutwa is a brilliant shaman, and what he contributed to our species in regard to the revelation of the white lions through Linda Tucker is something that every single human being involved in Gaian Echo Sorcery should know about. Every one of you should read The Mystery of the White Lions by Linda Tucker. There is extensive dialogues with Credo Mutwa in there, and it explains the origin of the predatory nature in our species, which is incredibly important to understand in coming events. So, unfortunately, however, Credo Mutwa was extremely traumatized by certain archonic interventions into his own psyche. And he himself admitted that he's very disturbed at what it did to him. For one thing, he admitted that it made him homosexual. And he's very ashamed of that. Not because there's anything morally wrong with it, but because it's against his understanding of manhood. I'm sure it is. Against his understanding of manhood as a Zulu shaman and warrior. He's very shocked. But it's a shocking revelation, and it's a way of saying, hold on here. You know, Credo Mutwa is a wonderful indigenous voice, an extremely significant indigenous voice, telling us things, some of which can be related to the Sophia mythos, but this is a man whose psyche has in some respect been shattered. And one evidence of this is that he repeats without critical scrutiny certain of the things that the Chidori, his name for the archons, have told him, which is a stupid thing to do, because he knows, as well as other people, that the Chidori / archons are liars and deceivers. So, you have to ask yourself, well, what do they lie and deceive about? Everything. Absolutely everything. And so anything that comes from them is a lie. The tale that comes from them through soothsayers and Chaldean psychic channelers in the ancient Middle East, the tale that they intervened in human genetics and created a hybrid between themselves and the indigenous people, the blackheads, you know, the black native people, is a lie. And so the story that there were two Chidori brothers, that is to say, two Archon ETs, who constructed the moon and put it in place, is a lie coming from the ultimate source of lies. And unfortunately, certain people who are dealing with the realm of myth and imagination just don't have the critical scrutiny, the sobriety, or the training to sort these things out properly. So, certain people who have become prominent by their expose of the New World Order, which, I might point out, hypes the New World Order just as much as it exposes it, gives it a godlike power and a mystique and a magic, while it gives no godlike power or magical mystique to the human species who are poor victims of these theocratic masterminds. Okay? The same voices that are singing in this chorus of ignorance and fear are now claiming that the moon is an artificial satellite put in place by ETs in order to mind program the human race. And nothing could be more ludicrous. And I don't even have to argue against it, Thomas. What we're seeing happen now is that the archontic structures, and this brings us back to the main subject, what is going to be happening with the archons with the intervention of Sophia underway, the correction. You can think of it as a correction, think of it as an intervention. What's going to be happening with the archons? Well, write this word on a piece of paper and stick it on your fridge. Absurdity. There is a passage that I quote in the article called Wisdom's Dare, which was published on Reality Sandwich recently. A passage from On the Origin of the World, in which Sophia confronts the archons even before the earth was created. and before humanity emerged. And she says, at the consummation of your works, you will be crushed by that luminous child. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the rare instances in the surviving material where we have a kind of prophetic vision being presented. It's part of the plot structure of the myth, and we would do well to observe it very carefully. It means that it is the intention of the wisdom goddess herself that the divine empowerment of the luminous child, humanity, out of our own empowerment, out of our own mind, heart, courage, vision, sobriety, daring, we defeat the archons at the consummation of their powers. What is the consummation of the power of the archon? Look at the word on a piece of paper stuck on your fridge. A lot of what we see in the world today, in terms of the authorities and the rulers, remember that's an alternative name for the archons, and the people who are archonified human beings are people who hold authority over others through an empty system of power and fraud and hoax. That whole system is way, way, way fucking out of control. And in fact, there is no way it can be corrected. And there is no human being or organization or legal process or visionary practice of ascension or planetary shift or using the secret. There is nothing that human beings can do to bring down that system. It comes down under the weight of its own absurdity. I'll give you an example. And we see this happening right before our eyes right now. Just watch what is happening in the world now, day by day and week by week. Recently, we had an incident in England where we saw one of the great, disgusting, revolting, theocratic, power-tripping psychopaths, Rupert Murdoch, get knocked off his throne, you know, which is a toilet, you know. Got knocked off his throne, off the toilet, and into the toilet, along with his redheaded friend, Rebecca whatever, who is a woman in alliance with theocracy, patriarchy, and divine paternalism. And women who are accessories to that go down with the system. There's a good lesson there. And what happened here is that a massive structure of archonic hoaxing and lying, which is the Rupert Murdoch media empire, collapses like a house of cards. And when we look at the particular reason why it collapses, what do we see? Well, we see that there is a scandal about the news reporters and the people in the employ, the prostitutes and the media whores and accessories to this hoax and this mind programming, are tapping the phones of, like, murdered children and are stealing information from people who are victims of 9/11. Well, I just want to point out that not only is that absolutely atrocious and unacceptable, but it's absurd. It's absurd. When, in order for someone like Rupert Murdoch to maintain his false mystique of power and his sense of being the puppet master and controlling the opinion of the world and manipulating the masses, which is all an illusion. It's illusions of power, folks. Illusions of power are the problem. Power is not the problem. If you want power, talk to me. Power is real. Power is joy. It's play. Power is part of love. It's daring. It's honest. Rupert Murdoch is not a man of power. He's a man in the illusions of power.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the illusion that goes down. And the illusion goes down through reaching the point of consummation, as Sophia herself understood. The consummation of the total and complete absurdity. The same thing is happening in the United States. It's taking a while, but it's happening with the TSA. When you have TSA agents who have an authority, get this, let me see if I can say this. There's a human being standing in front of you in a uniform when you're ready to get on an airplane, and this person, who has no personal authority out of their own self, is invoking a system based on a chain of command that goes back to someone else who has no authority. And they're enforcing this illusory authority on a free person. That whole system is false. It's a hoaxed, rigged system. And it goes down at the moment that it reaches total absurdity. And I would say that when you have TSA agents filling in the diapers of a six-month-old child to see if there is a bomb in there, then we have reached the point of absurdity of the archonic powers.
No, I think you're absolutely right. We've come right to the very dead end, the culmination of the absurdity. Now, are you saying that the absurdity itself then, by its own weight and its own nonsense, brings itself down? Or are you saying that there's an introduction of factors from Gaia Sophia as well?
It brings itself down, she brings it down, and it brings itself down. But she adds to it the boost that brings it down with a massive wallop, you know? It's like a Rube Goldberg machine that just collapses under an absurdity of levers and wheels and springs and sprockets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It will collapse. It is collapsing. The TSA terrorism, the false terrorism hoax is collapsing, and people are getting fed up with it. So I just want to point out that the factor of absurdity is writ large in the Sophia mythos. The archons are absurd. They're senseless. They just like to fuck with our minds and to vicariously get off on our fear and confusion, which feeds them psychically. So I want to point out that the opportunity that's happening now is threefold. First, there's the opportunity to watch these great archonic authoritarian structures like the media empire of Rupert Murdoch or like the Homeland Security hoax in the United States or the carbon tax hoax or the eco-fascism hoax, which is saying we have to exterminate 9/10 of the population to save the earth, you know. These hoaxes are all collapsing under their own absurdity, under the massive encumberment of their own absurdity and the difficulty it takes to maintain them 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So that's one thing we're looking at. The second thing is we're looking at Sophia herself bolting. I use this word. She bolts. B-O-L-T. She's not called VV for nothing. This flirtatious thunderbolt strikes like thunder. And she strikes by pure intention. I have to take some time and talk very carefully about what that means. You need to have had the experience of very close proximity to an aeon in order to know how the power of intention works at that level of cosmic existence. But I'll give you an analogy that I think may be user-friendly, because this would be my attempt to explain how she bolts. How Sophia jolts down the rotting system that is already falling. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Please.
If anyone has ever had a lucid dream, you will know that something remarkable happens when you're having a lucid dream, and it can even happen in an ordinary dream. But generally, it's a characteristic of a lucid dream, and it's an unmistakable experience. It's stuck, and you can't miss it. Castaneda also spoke on several occasions about this fact. Say I'm having a lucid dream and I'm sitting in a cafe with some friends, and suddenly I realize I'm having a lucid dream. I realize I'm in a dream. I look around. I think, wow, this is a dream. But I'm awake. I'm physically present in some manner, some virtual kind of physical being. I can act in my dream. How do you act in a lucid dream? Well, all you have to do is intend something. So, for instance, if I'm sitting in this cafe at a table and I realize that I'm a lucid dream and I look across the cafe and there's the bar, and sitting at the bar is a lovely Cuban-Romanian woman with a gap between her teeth who happens to attract me, okay? So I want to go and talk to this woman. And there I am talking to her. How does that happen? It happens because in the lucid dreaming state, intention translates directly and immediately into action.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever had that, have you ever had that experience?
Oh, yes, of course.
I think many people have, and it's a good lesson because it prepares you to understand what that phenomena, that dynamic, would be like if you magnified it 10 billion times.
Mm-hmm.
Then you come to the power of an aeon. What I say about Sophia may sound naive. It may sound like I'm just another guy talking about God, although I call it the goddess, and I'm, you know, giving you a bunch of make-believe here. When I tell you, she can do anything she wants. If she wants to turn the Atlantic Ocean into pea soup, she can do it by her intention. All she has to do is intend. The power of intention of a dreaming aeon, the power of intention of an aeon, is the axis of her dreaming. You think of the dreaming of an aeon as like an electromagnetic field that propagates at right angles to its axis. And the axis of that propagating field of dreaming is intention. So, if Sophia intends to bring down the total infrastructure of the false rigged authority on this planet, she can bring it down with a wink of her eye. And she is doing so. And I've seen how she does it. It's very interesting. This is something you can see in the second attention. There is not enough scope or concentration to see it in the first attention, which is linear and logical thinking. You have to enter into the dreaming to a certain degree in order to see what the dreaming does, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what she does very simply is that she goes to the infrastructure, the psychic infrastructure. Now, we don't know what the psychic infrastructure is because generally we don't pay attention to it. But I'll give you an example of how it works. You take any person listening to this, I would guarantee, and even myself and you to a certain extent perhaps, if we had the opportunity to be in a room with, Henry Kissinger or some powerful person or maybe just some media person, you know, some actor or actress or Noam Chomsky or whatever. I'm at a talk and I'm sitting two people away from Noam Chomsky and I have an opportunity to talk to Noam Chomsky, right? What am I going to do? How am I going to feel? How would an ordinary person feel?
Well, if you're in awe of the person, you're going to feel nervous, you're going to feel tense.
That's right.
You're going to feel elated in a sense. Yeah.
You're going to feel elated by the contact, but you're going to feel nervous, you're going to feel shaky,
mm-hmm.
Your voice is going to shake, you're going to stand up in front of this person, and even though you know very, very clearly what you want to say, something about being in the presence of that person makes you shake.
Mm-hmm.
That is because behind such people, there is a deep infrastructure of the archetypes of authority that have been imposed upon the human psyche for many, many centuries.
Mm.
And if you want to go back to the origin of these archetypes, go to a mythology book or go on the internet and Google in images Assyrian gods. And you come up with all these images of like these so-called Anunnaki gods, these terribly powerful-looking kind of reptilian angels, you know, the typical-looking mm-hmm. Anunnaki gods, the typical reptilians. And you see many images of them that were taken from the walls of the temple of Assurbanipal and the temples in Nineveh and all this. Those images were planted and laid into the human psyche 4,000 years ago as images of fear and intimidation. And today, when you stand in front of someone who has that illusion of power about them, that whole infrastructure vibrates in your psyche because that person who has no real power actually is connected to the archetypal infrastructure. And that is what makes you feel fear and trembling and intimidation in front of such people. Okay?
Yes, so it comes translated out in your psyche, in your physical being, as if actual physical force, a power, but it's not originating from a real power in that sense. It's an illusion from the get-go.
That's right. It's a phantom power that they trigger. You know, people like figures of power like Murdoch, Henry Kissinger, are like tuning forks. And when you hit the tuning fork, the infrastructure of all these layers and layers of these kings, queens, theocrats, mythical beings, hybrids between humans and beings, all these images of fear and domination that have been implanted in the human psyche in order to control us and keep us from realizing our divine endowment, resonate to that tuning fork. And so it's natural that even the most composed person and sober person would feel fear and trembling in the presence of the Queen of England, who is nothing. The Queen of England is nothing. She's not even got the presence of a bag lady. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By contrast, when you're in the presence of someone of true power, well, your mouth waters because it's so delicious. And all you want to do is just play with it. It's erotic, you know, and you want to touch it, and you want to be in it, and you want to mingle with it. And there's a joy and a freedom in being in the presence of someone who emanates true power. So power is a good thing, and power is what she's giving us now. And the power she's giving us, I tell you, my friends, is like nothing you could ever imagine. Prepare to be overwhelmed. She is knocking out these infrastructures as I speak. And this is the great opportunity that I have as a sky diviner and a Turton, because I can read the sidereal code banks. And by tracing the movement of the lunar apogee and the lunar perigee, I can give a sort of provisional syntax to show you what she's doing. And you really need this, because she could do it and we would not, and we would miss it. You see?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is what any teacher does, right? Isn't it, Thomas? It's very simple. There's nothing complicated or mysterious about it. If you go out in a nature walk with a teacher of botany, they will give you the syntax to observe the formation of leaves and the activity of plants that you would pass by unnoticing. That's all that I'm doing. And I can tell you for sure that she is hitting, bolting these archaic infrastructure is very, very hard. So while they're falling down around us from the weight of their own absurdity, she is adding her supernatural intention to bring them down super hard, super hard. And at the same time, she's bringing us into alignment with her journey and with her power. And all this happens through her story.
Okay, John, let's go ahead and move into, I'm looking through the notes that you supplied me, and one thing that I wanted to talk about as well was, and we've talked about this many times before, is the absolute immensity, importance, and the grounding factor of the Sophia myth itself. And in the notes here, you talk about, you're comparing the Sophia myth with a lodestone. You call it the lodestone of human imagination. Would you like to talk about that and perhaps lead into the NLP properties and the organic light as well?
Certainly would love to do that. Each time I speak now, I have the opportunity to do interviews quite a bit lately. I don't like to repeat myself as such, you know. But I want to repeat and reiterate and clarify each time I speak about the importance of the Sophia mythos, because I believe that the importance and the singularity and power of this mythos is breaking into people's minds now. And I just want to confirm the obvious, in a sense. I think a metaphor that's really helpful to understand the power of the Sophia, the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia, which is now Dare. Don't call it the fall of the fallen goddess scenario anymore. That part is the past. We are now in the future part of the story, in correction. And I'd like to call it Wisdom's Dare. We're exploring and understanding what was Wisdom's Dare. Wisdom made a dare to our species. What did she dare us to do? This is something to think about. If you love us, if you're attracted to the divine Sophia, if you want to encounter the organic light, just think about that. Just think that there is a divine being embodied in this earth, and she dares you. So, the importance of the story is that human imagination is our great faculty endowed by Sophia herself. While the archonic structures of authority, the rigged and hoaxed games of our world, are collapsing, and she is adding her supernatural intent, we have a role. It's not just, she's not just here to rescue us. We're not passive servers in this great event. And our role is to use the faculty she gave us specifically for the final defeat of the Archons. We defeat them when they're going down. And that is necessary. It is absolutely necessary for us to exercise this power to keep them down. Because if we don't, as a human species, play our role in the defeat of the Archons, they will come back because they are very pesky devils. And the interspecies predators who are now going down will come back unless we take them out permanently. And so these are our responsibilities. Now, as far as imagination goes, your imagination is like a magnetic field. And a magnetic field is invisible, so your imagination is invisible. So just picture yourself, say, taking a walk through the countryside somewhere. You're walking through a valley, and there are mountains around you, there are rivers, there are trees, forests. You can see the various details of the landscape. What you see of the sensuous natural world is given to you by your senses and is calibrated and measured into your mind by the first attention, which is the linear logical attention focused in the left eye. Well, at the same time that you're in this setting, walking up this beautiful valley, you're also in a magnetic field that you can't see. And some of the rocks by the river and some of the mountains have a particular magnetism, and your body, being a magnetic instrument in itself, responds to the magnetism, the geomagnetism of the planet, but it responds in a chaotic way. And so, just as you need a compass to find your way through an unknown territory so that you go in a chosen direction, the compass doesn't tell you which direction to go in. It just keeps you to the direction of your journey. So, the Sophia story is the compass that keeps us to the direction of our journey. Now, this journey has many twists and turns. This journey has, each individual person has many things to discover on this journey. But as a whole for our species, this journey has a particular direction, which is toward her dreaming and toward interactivity with her, to the highest potential of cosmic magic. That is the direction of this journey. And what takes us in that direction is the compass or a lodestone and story. I took this quote off Wikipedia, I think. A lodestone, L-O-D-E-S, stone, is a naturally magnetized piece of the mineral magnetite. They are naturally occurring magnets that attract pieces of iron. Ancient people first discovered the property of magnetism in lodestones. How wonderful is that? Because we are finding now, how important the property of magnetism is in our connection to the Earth Goddess. We are like particles in her electro-geomagnetic field. Pieces of lodestone suspended so they could turn, picture a rock on a string, and the rock turns, were the first magnetic compasses, and their importance in early navigation is indicated by the name lodestone, which in Middle English means coarse stone or leading stone.
Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor, a beautiful comparison.
Now, you know, I've been compared to, you know, said to be the heir of Joseph Campbell, certainly not comparable to him in many ways, but I would be in the sense that I took up with complete dedication to carry out his work. In creative mythology, he presented 4 points of what he considered to be the emergent mythology of the future of the 21st century, which he considered to be a mythogenetic moment of unparalleled importance, perhaps only reflected back by a moment in the 12th century. And what I see now is that in planetary tantra and in the restoration of the Sophia myth, you have Joseph Campbell's dream fulfilled. You have creative mythology, and you have it at warp speed. I mean, his socks would be blown off if he were here today. His socks would be totally blown off, because he would see that not only have we achieved it, we have a species that have come to the threshold of what he saw and predicted and proposed. But when we come into this creative mythology, which I call directive or applied mythology, you enter it at warp speed. It's 0 to 150 in under a second.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Yeah, it is. And this is really great, folks. I don't want to sound like I'm hyping it here. I'm just telling you how it works. And Thomas and other people, I think, will back me up on it. But I'm emphasizing this because I want to point out that you don't have to work and groan and grind and do any kind of spiritual practice to get here. When you get on board with this myth, because it is the true story of the empowerment of our species by the divine being who engineered us, you get a boost that you can't get from anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the directive power of the course stone, C-O-U-R-S-E, the stone that shows the course. Because I warn you that your imagination is not your own. And there are only 2 ways that you can use it. I quote again the wonderful formula from the alchemical compilation of the 16th, 17th century. In all thine operations, let the work be guided by nature, according to the slow progression of metals in the bowels of the earth. And in thine efforts, be guided in all ways by the true and not the fantastic imagination. So I warn you that your imagination is not your own. And if you treat it as if it is, it becomes nothing but a narcissistic gimmick. And you end up being Lady Gaga or one of her fans. And that is a horrible fate. And Lady Gaga, I won't say anything about her right now.
Yeah, you might want to hold off on that for a bit.
Yeah, I'll hold off on that for a couple of months. Anyway, so what is the difference between the true and the fantastic imagination? Well, as I said recently on the Freedom American, the true imagination is the one that is integral to her story and unfolds in the framework of her story. And the false and fantastic imagination is everything that does it. So, the power of the dreaming of the goddess melds into your own imagination and gives you actually a superhuman and godlike dimension of power, if you want to put it that way. But this is not a god trip. We're not playing gods. We're playing with a goddess. Keep that distinction very well in mind. We are not gods, but we are capable, as the Telestai were, of acquiring divine powers in a co-dynamic, in a power-sharing arrangement. If we attempt to acquire or develop these so-called divine powers in any other way, we become psychotic. And that is what has happened to the ruling class and the ruling elite, who think they are gods. Because they are not developing their imagination and their potential as human beings. In a power-sharing dynamic with the source of life, they are demented, and they are representatives of where you get if you take the path of the fantastic imagination. You get nowhere except into self-annihilation and narcissism.
Yeah, that power then devours you. It takes you down. It eats you up. It breaks you apart.
Yeah, these people, you know, are being, to a certain extent, they are being brought down by their own agenda. They're being eaten up by their own agenda. They've overshot themselves, you know. The problem with the Archons, as I said in the beginning, and the Gnostics taught, they don't cause us to make mistakes, but they insinuate a spin that carries mistakes beyond the scale of correction, beyond the human scale. These New World Order control freaks and these psychopaths and serial killers and banking mafias and media freaks and liars that are running around the planet are way, way beyond the scale of correction. And I would say of them that they are in perfect control of everything in their illusion of control. But even in their illusion of control, they can't control themselves. So where in the fuck are they going to end up? And what we're seeing now is the downfall of all that. But at the same time, we have a huge responsibility. Because when the archonic system collapses on many, many fronts, it's the responsibility of our species to come in and put in a system of knowledge, a system of education, a system of culture, a system of the arts, a system of politics, a system of ethics. And man, am I going to be talking about this soon. Gaian ethics. To put in the system that will live and have such vitality and truth in it that the old system cannot reboot itself. Because the problem with the Archons is that they reboot very quickly. This is one of their advantages over us. They reboot and recover very quickly. And so what we want, the goal that we want to focus on now as human beings, is to keep that archonic system of hoaxing and lying and deceit and secrecy and manipulation, to keep it from recurring. It's not our total responsibility to bring it down. She's going to bring it down. But it's our total responsibility to keep it from recurring. Is that clear?
That is very clear. That makes so many things were going through my head as you were saying that. The reactions that I've had myself and then the people that have been involved in this, say, from around January. Yeah, the people are going through, in a sense, the same paradigms, the same things they need to work out. And one of the first things that comes across, at least in my case, and I would say in many others, is the inability to deal with lies and deception. That just drops away. And any interest in going into the conspiracies and figuring out who's behind all this, that all drops away, and you're more propelled with the desire to figure out how are we going to make this work into a sustainable, beautiful, ethical, strong framework. And that becomes kind of your main desire in life.
Indeed it does. I would say, Thomas, it's a good characterization of what I'm seeing as well through the messages I receive, you know, from people who contact me. This is the shift from problem to solution. All these people who are going into, you know, the Freemasons and the Jesuits and going down these rabbit holes, excuse me, folks, but there's no answer down the rabbit hole. And I've warned you before that don't play games with serial killers, because when you're playing their game and trying to figure out their codes, you're giving them power, and they're on to their next trips that they're going to play on you. We don't play games with serial killers. If you meet one, you have to take it out. I mean, stop them dead. And this is another subject coming up on the horizon. And in fact, Gaia herself will bring it up. Gaia's making a hit. She makes hits. And she's making a hit on August 2nd, 2011. that has some tremendous ramifications in terms of facing interspecies predators. And I'm riding that hit. And I'm going to...
So August 2nd, that would be the occurrence of a perigee surge. Yeah, okay.
The next perigee surge. Oh. And I'm riding that hit and do my best to provide some kind of descriptive framework for you to see what this is. No, at no point in human history was the syntax of the Nahual more crucial than it is right now. Because we need the syntax. You asked me the question about NLP. There's a massive rewiring of human circuits going on now, of human neuronal circuits, in connection with the rewiring of the whole geomagnetic field of the Earth. She is changing, reconfiguring the whole system of the geomagnetism and the bioelectricity of the Earth. And as she does so, in every single person, in your brain, in your nervous system, in the cells of your body, in your ribosomes, your ATP, this new configuration is emerging. And the purpose of a syntax or a descriptive framework is to enable you to see what is actually being done. Because it's only when you can see what is actually being done by the goddess that you can then combine your will and intention with what she's doing. So, Nahual syntax and the correct syntax is tremendously important at this point in correction, and will be so for the remaining 3 years or so, during which correction, the initial conditions of correction are being set in 3 years, which is 10 seconds of her time.
So you'll be focusing on that in writings and in the writings you post to the mailing list, and then I would guess in the interviews as well, huh?
In the interviews and in the writings, I am proposing this description of this momentous hit that she's made. It's the sixth hit that she's made in the perigee surges since March 11th. I really need to start out by talking about the first hit, which was breaking the chiral lock between the right and the left eye, which she made in March of 19.
Chiral lock, so that's C-H-I-R-A-L.
Yeah, chiral is okay. From the Greek word kairos, meaning hand. And chirality, it's the word chiropractor, is somebody who works with you with their hands. Chirality is that property of the universe which is called handedness. It's also called gender. You know, some people have objected to my use, which is traditional in the sacred mysteries, to speak about gods and goddesses and gender deities, but it is in fact true. Deities are gendered, and the universe is fractally arranged along mirroring corridors of chiral dynamics, that is handedness, right and left. And we have, right in the middle of our eyes, a point that is not a third eye of superior seeing, but it's a lock between the peripheral vision of the right and the left side. You see peripherally in one way through your right eye, and then that overlaps the peripheral vision of your left eye. Can you follow that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There, imagine them like two big lenses of sunglasses, two big rounded plate glass lenses, and they overlap. And what the archons manage to do, and they do this by frequency entrainment and by flickering, they do it by every means of the media that reduces your attention span. By reducing the attention span through television, through the flicker of the screen, and by all these archonic devices that we have, by the jackhammer editing of MTV music videos, where you see someone dancing, but you never actually see them dancing for more than a fraction of a second. This is an archonic device that causes an unnatural freezing of these two plates. The left peripheral field plate, which carries the first attention, and the right peripheral field plate, which carries the second attention, ought to flow freely over each other, like tectonic plates in subduction. So they should flow freely. And when they flow freely, the first attention, which is logical linear thinking, and the second attention, which is dreaming and imagination, can complement and contribute to each other. But what the Archons do, and this is one of their main interventions, there's a second one as well that operates at the back of your head. What they do is that they cause those two peripheral plates to be locked, unnaturally locked, and they seize up. And the effects of that are disastrous for our species. First of all, it separates logical and linear and scientific thinking from imagination. So you have supposedly science over here, facts, evidence, blah, 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 and imagination and fantasy over there, whereas neither of those things is true. The only reality is the two of them working together. That's the truth. And what she did to, at the onset of correction, on March 19th, when the velocity of the barycenter of the Earth exceeded the speed of sound, is she bolted the chiral lock and she broke it open. And the effects of this are now being seen in everybody that contacts me. They tell me all consistently the same thing. And I read what they're saying as an effect that this lock is now free and we have to keep it free. Cannot let it seize up. And that was the first blow that Sophia made. And coming up on the 2nd of August will be the 6th blow. So she has been really working on our case with the pure power of her intention. And the fantastic thing is, absolutely fantastic. I mean, I can't imagine a more amazing time to be alive. You can actually know what she's doing and how she's doing it.
Yeah, you mentioned the last time about July 7th one, which was a boost to the psychic immune
psychic
function.
Immunity. That's right.
Yeah.
A boost to the immune system of the thymus in the upper chest. So that sums up what I can say so far. We're at the 1 minute and 1 hour and 6 minutes of my recording. So I think we're
right
to stop here, Thomas. And
we're right at the borderline there. Exactly. Well, let's... I propose that we just do this again in 48 hours and continue on.
Sounds
you
fine
are,
to me.
Okay.
So we're talking about Friday.
Okay. Friday, yes. Okay, very good. Well, let's go ahead and close things up for today. And I just want to mention one thing as we close here. You know, I started this radio show totally by a series of coincidences and events 8 months ago. I never imagined that I would be in this position, you know, 8 or 9 months ago. And I would like to just say out to people who are out there listening and getting involved in Planetary Tantra, in whatever function you have, whether you're an artist, a webmaster, a translator, book editor, whatever, try to see how you could bring your abilities into helping Planetary Tantra spread out in an effective and intelligent manner. So if you have any ideas that way, please contact John or even myself about that.
Excellent.
So, John, okay, let's go ahead and sign off for today, and we'll pick it up here in about 47 hours.
Okay, Thomas, thank you again so much, and thanks to all of you who are listening.
Great.
Bye for now.
Thank you very much. Good night.